This is an ABC podcast.
And as we head towards a target of net zero by 2050, debate has started in some circles around the role and the impacts of agriculture when it comes to combating climate change. This is Cabinet Minister Bridget McKenzie.
We need to understand the role that we can play positively in lowering emissions, obviously. But it's not up to us to come up with the plan. It's actually for the plan to be developed using the best science and evidence, and so that we can confidently sign up to something that we know shares the cost equally. There's a lot of people out there that think signing up to something like this will have no cost. Well, the reality is someone will have to pay it. We want to make sure it won't be our people and our industries.
So what plans are already in place within the agricultural industries? Families, businesses, making changes and adapting. And how do we pivot to not only try and ensure that jobs and industry are protected, but the environment is protected at the same time? Today on the Conversation Hour, we want to look at the direction, the innovation and the changes that are already being made within farming practices, from cattle to grain, from intensive to small scale and micro farming. How will the future of farming look as we head towards a target of net zero by 2050? What is climate friendly farming? And what role do we all play in the future of this industry? Fergus O'Connor is a South Gippsland beef farmer at Berry's Creek, just near Leongatha, a beautiful part of Victoria. He's also a member of FCA, which is Farmers for Climate Change Action. Fergus, I'm just going to ask you the most obvious question in the nicest possible way. Are people surprised that a cattle farmer can also be passionate about the environment?
I don't think so at all. I think lots of people are doing lots of things, and cattle production is just one of them. And I'm very keen on nature and the environment, and it all goes hand in hand.
So tell us a little bit about how you make that go hand in hand.
Well, we look at the whole farm, really. And, I mean, on our farm, we have a brilliant spring that's fed from aquifers underground. Along that spring line, we've planted trees and fenced it off. We've planted 18,500 trees on the property. We've introduced rotational grazing, and our pastures now are much cleaner because we've got rid of the weeds.
Can I just ask you, what is rotational grazing?
You put the cattle in the paddock, in our case, for a week, and then move them on to the next paddock. So the paddock's eaten out nicely, rather than set stocking. And with rotational grazing, it actually sequesters carbon quite a lot. It acts as a carbon pump and sequesters carbon. So we're sequestering carbon with our rotational grazing, and that in itself is producing a better soil for us, because through that we can retain more moisture in our soils. You know, on average it's about 150,000 litres per 1% increase of soil carbon on your property. And we've increased our soil carbon in the last 4 years from 2% to 4.5%. So we're sequestering carbon in large amounts, which is fantastic for the environment and has a really good effect on you know, our balance with our cattle and our emissions from them.
I'm going to have to ask a lot of stupid questions today, Fergus, and I'm just going to ask them. How long has rotational grazing been a part of cattle farming? Is this a relatively new concept, and how widespread is it? Do many people do this?
Oh, lots and lots of people. Dairy farmers do it all the time. You know, they rotational graze. They go, I mean, they use one paddock a day and then go to another paddock and another paddock every day and every night. And so they're doing that. And it's just in our case, it also reduces worm infestations. So we don't have to use chemicals to control worm loads in cattle, whereas if you're set stock, you have the problem with worms and that sort of thing, whereas with rotational grazing, for us, it has enormous benefits, and the cattle are then eating the grass at its optimum value, so they're putting on more weight quicker, and so you're finishing your cattle off and getting them processed quicker than other methods. So it's just a win-win for us and a win-win for our cattle and a win-win for the environment. Yeah.
Speaking of grass, I want to talk about the grass that you have in your area and on your farm, because that's something that you've looked into, isn't it? Because that can make a difference in terms of the amount of methane that's actually emitted from cattle.
Absolutely. If you have a mixed grass, you know, you have your legumes, your plantains and your coxfoots, which are predominantly very deep-rooted, and then you have your rye grasses as well, which are predominantly shorter-rooted, you draw on the depth of water in your soil and moisture and also the depth of minerals rather than just having one particular bland type of grass. But they've showed with studies, you know, researchers have used mixed species, and the more different species of grasses and legumes and plantains and that sort of thing you have in your paddocks, that actually reduces the methane that the cattle are emitting as well. So all these things come together, and you're actually doing very, very well with your cattle and your environment. But it's just very, very simple and very common sense based, because it's just like you and me having a balanced diet rather than just eating one particular thing that would probably make you feel not very well.
When we talk about changes that need to be made as we head towards a net zero by 2050, there's been a lot of discussion around the role that the government plays here. And I think the slogan that's been thrown around is technology, not taxes. What do you think about that? I mean, what role does the government have here in terms of incentives to help farmers? And how can technology help farmers like yourself work towards reducing carbon emissions?
I think the government can advise you, and they can also help with changing your production. But also research has an enormous bearing on what goes on, and that's probably basically funded by government. You know, with select breeding of different cattle that can reduce methane, and there's big tests going on with asparagus, you know, which is the seaweed-based thing, which reduces methane by 80%. There's also vaccines that probably will come online. They tell me at Melbourne Uni they're getting very close to producing a vaccine which reduces methane. So there are all these things that government can do. And Meat and Livestock Australia are very, very active in helping farmers, and they're producing, you know, things that you wouldn't even think about, but they're producing meat trays for butchers that are made out of sugarcane waste. And
so those changes are occurring.
The changes are already happening, and MLA are fantastic, and they're producing sugarcane cellophane, you know, instead of plastic cellophane. So although people don't hear about a lot of these things a lot of the time because they don't think farming's very interested, or there's enormous amounts going on.
And it impacts us all. We're going to try and talk about some of those plans and some of those things that are going on. Fergus, thanks so much for your time. It's been interesting to learn a little bit today. Fergus O'Connor is a South Gippsland beef farmer at Berrys Creek near Leongatha, and also a member for Farmers for Climate Action. This text, multi-millionaires talking about climate change. Are you kidding me? And another says here, I'm a farmer and an ex-national member. Bridget just isn't up to speed with the changes that are already being made in grain farming. Richard's called from Glen Iris. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
Good morning. What did you want to say?
Well, I understand the topic is what we can do to ameliorate climate change, et cetera, et cetera. The emphasis at the moment is on net zero, and the figure, the date has been set at 2050, which is just too late. It's a ridiculous suggestion that we go to net zero by 2050. We've got to get there a lot quicker. In fact, by that time, we should be going negative carbon. We should be drawing it down. And there's actually only one way we can draw it down, and that is with farming techniques, and I'm referring to all the regenerative farming techniques that we know are well established now. The last gentleman spoke about government research. A lot of the government research from this government is money going towards the very companies who are responsible for the problem in the first place. The farming, the chemical farming conglomerates, which globally turn over approximately one third of $1 trillion.
So, Richard, can I ask, when we talk about how, I guess, how this impacts us all and how we all are somehow connected to farming, whether we, you know,
I'm getting there. Okay. These pesticides, fertilizers, and other chemicals and other farming methods, they're destroying the land. The farmers who are doing it are only doing it because they believe that is the what they should do. They are not doing that out of willful neglect or destruction. That is what they have been told for generations now, since the 50s. The Green Revolution, which was the beginning of this, was well-meaning, very well-intended, and saved a lot of lives, but it was half the story, because at that time, the actual chemistry, the biology, the botany of the soil biome, and the interconnectedness of that biome to plant growth via photosynthesis and fixing carbon as soil was not understood. What a lot of people don't actually even know now, unless you're an avid gardener and some farmers, plants actually grow soil. They don't just sit in soil, they grow the soil. And it's basically a carbon organic matrix which they live in. That locks up carbon.
All right. Good on you, Richard. I'm gonna say goodbye because you've had a really good crack now, and we've been trying to follow a lot of what you've been saying. But what I'm interested in too is that, you know, how passionate you are, and given that you're from Glen Iris as well, that this is certainly just not a regional and rural issue. There's a text here from Jess in Thorpedale. It says here in brackets in Gippsland. I totally know where Thorpedale is. My goodness, spent many of my childhood days playing with a wonderful family up in Thorpedale. You bring home the spud mud on your shoes, though, and it says here, I am a potato and sheep farmer's wife. The best thing we can do is pick up those spotty apples, the overripe peaches, the very large small potatoes, or the otherwise imperfect fruit and vegetables. Supermarkets have such strict parameters for the produce they will pay for, and this is driven by consumers. This means that so much of our consumable food is simply wasted, which is also wasting the energy, the CO2 that took to produce those vegetables. Beautifully said, Jess, because the thing is, we all do play a role. And we're seeing some small changes in supermarkets, but, you know, the odd little section at the end of an aisle for the odd bunch or whatever it might be, it's really not going far enough, is it? Dr. Christopher O'Brien is an ecologist at the School of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Queensland. And Christopher, we spoke to you a few weeks ago around feral pigs and the damage that they're causing to the environment. I mean, is there such a thing as climate-friendly farming?
Hi, good morning. Climate-friendly farming, that's a very good question. And I would say that'd be very case-specific. And some people would say it's a oxymoronic statement. Others might say, yeah, absolutely, they're interconnected, and there are ways we can sequester carbon, and there are lots of opportunities in agriculture for reducing emissions, no doubt about it.
What are some of the bigger things we need to look at? Is, I know previously we spoke about soil disturbance. Is that one of the major issues we need to look at?
It's definitely one of the parts of the story, right? Because, I mean, if you look at the Earth's terrestrial surface, about half of the planet is covered by agriculture in some form. And most of agriculture requires some transformation of the soil, or what we call land use change. And that land use change comes in the form of deforestation at first to make the land suitable for agriculture. So there are these initial effects in terms of emissions, and there are a lot of other direct and indirect effects as well that can either be slowed down or reversed in some cases.
When we think about agriculture and farming and emissions, we often think about things like cattle, don't we? But what about when we look at legumes, when we look at grains and pulses, soy? What else do we need to look at?
Yeah, it's a great point because, you know, we often focus on the livestock themselves or the direct practices, but oftentimes these indirect effects of agriculture are the most telling in terms of their carbon footprint. So food production for livestock is a big one, especially, in the developing world, the developed world as well, but you tend to see that this effect even greater in the developing world, where there's a massive production of feed like soy products, right? And to produce the amount of soy required to feed cattle, you know, requires land use change, requires deforestation, requires fertilization, lots of land use practices that have massive emissions. That's right.
There's a text here that just says a very short and succinct line that says stop land clearing. How much of that is an issue?
Land clearing is huge. Anybody who's spent time in this space would tell you, Australia is not doing very well on this front. I mean, a couple of years ago, there are some big reports that came out showing that Australia was top 10 in the world in deforestation and was the only developed country on that top 10 list. My understanding is that hasn't really changed much, and it seems like year after year these bleak reports come out. And, unfortunately, once you remove a mature native stand of forest, it's incredibly hard, incredibly expensive, labor-intensive to restore that habitat. And that's just the vegetation itself. We're not talking about other forms of carbon, such as the native biodiversity. And look, we're living in a planet where now there's an estimated 60% of all mammal biomass in the world is livestock, and the majority of that is cattle. So wild mammals, native mammals, are only 4% of the world's biomass now.
While we have you, Christopher, I actually want to have a chat to Ron. He's in the Docklands. Hi, Ron.
G'day, how are you?
Good, mate. What did you want to say?
Well, look, one thing I think we need to be careful of is to actually not separate farming from us or anything that we do from the human component. That is, one of the best things we can do is to stop eating meat. I mean, Attenborough claims that if everyone became vegetarian, something like half the world's arable land or land that's currently under cropping would be able to be returned to wilderness, and that would have a double effect, reducing the amount of methane and also sequestering a lot of carbon into wilderness.
But is it worth having those conversations if it's actually not going to happen, Ron? Like, I mean, the fact is, as a society, we're all not going to stop eating meat. We might all start to reduce eating meat, and many of us may become vegetarian or vegan or whatever it is. And in other countries like Asia, there's not a lot of meat consumption. But is it going to happen? I mean, do we need to think of other solutions?
Well, there is no one single solution. But, I mean, in answer to your question, I would say, why not? I mean, I'm 70 and I've stopped eating meat. I've become vegetarian for a couple of reasons. It's been better for my health, but predominantly because of the fact that by the time I'm my age, my grandson will be, it'll be 1990 by the time he's my age. It's like 2090. Now, that's a long way out. And when you look at the predictions, somebody has to do something. And I think that can become aware of it, it's not a hard thing to do. It's cheaper anyhow.
And it feels like you have some control. I find that interesting too. And a lot of today's conversation is around that we're all involved in this. This is not just farmers versus the rest of us. This is all of us.
I was involved in agribusiness for a while, and most of the farmers that I haven't met a farmer who didn't believe that climate change was real. It's just bizarre that they're political party doesn't sort of represent the people that they started representing because of, you know, the coal that we all know about. But
well, there's a few texts saying a very similar thing to you, Ron, actually, saying that, you know, I'm a farmer, and sorry about the pun, but farmers are at the coal front of climate change. Bridget McKenzie has it wrong. She shouldn't have the focus on the cost of change. If we don't do something about climate change now, all farmers will suffer financially from the hotter and drier climate. Good on you, Ron. It was really good to chat with you. Dr. Christopher O'Brien is with you, ecologist at the School of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Queensland. Christopher, is Ron right? If we all just stopped eating meat, would that go, you know, a hell of a long way towards some of the problems that we're all facing?
You know, I do have to hand it to Ron. He's on the right track because, you know, there are decisions we make, and, you know, the lady who texted in also touched on this about the consumerism and how the consumer has an impact in the market and what's driving a lot of these emissions. So, you know, making small changes in our behavior. You know, you don't have to necessarily get rid of meat overnight, but there's a preponderance of data. There's a huge amount of data showing that making small shifts in your diet away from, you know, eating red meat all the time to shifting to, say, poultry, and then, you know, from poultry shifting, you know, more to, you know, plant-based diet, and making small shifts, you know, just the shift from red meat to poultry, for example, has orders of magnitude less emissions per capita. So you can make changes where meat is still in your diet, at least at first, to sort of get to that healthier, not only for the planet, but healthier for our bodies as well.
Yet there's some reports decisions. That are saying at the moment we're actually eating more meat than ever due to lockdown. There were butchers last night saying that they're seeing an increase of sales of around 40% at the moment. And that's because we're all at home and we're cooking more. So maybe we'd just be eating that meat out. So whether or not our meat consumption is going up is yet to be determined. But if the butchers have anything to say about this, they're saying that, you know, we certainly are buying a lot more meat.
Yeah, not surprised.
Do you think that farmers play the biggest role here when it comes to heading towards a net target of a zero by 2050?
Of course, they have a role to play, and we all have a role to play. You know, as the previous caller mentioned, there's you know, it's a connected system. So, you know, as consumers, we have a role to play. As farmers, they have a role to play as well. You know, of course, this goes up to government decisions. You know, big decisions have to be made. You know, we need to act on those decisions.
Dr. Christopher O'Brien, it's always fascinating speaking with you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks a lot.
He's ecologist at the School of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Queensland. Let's have a chat with Bill. Bill's in Mildura. Hi, Bill.
Yes. What you're saying is all good, and it's reasonably emotive. I'm an agricultural scientist, and I've got a couple of things to say. Yes, at the moment, the data is indicating the globe is warming. That's a fact. Okay, we don't have access to future data. So we don't really know what's going to happen in 5 or 10 years' time. We don't know, okay? Scientists only can comment on real data, actual data, not predictions of what's going to happen.
Now, there's some fairly strong predictions, though, of what's going to happen, Bill, and that's what we're trying to plan for, so you can still think about that.
Sorry. Would you like me to make a prediction about a medicine that you take based on future data?
Well, it would depend on who was making that prediction for me and whether or not they thought it was going to help me or not. But predictions, they're just a part of life. Bill, good on you. Great to hear from you as well. This text, the vegetarian argument is bogus. What do you replace meat with in your diet? More crops are more damaging to the environment ultimately. Grazing animals on pasture is a proper fashion that can produce and can sequester carbon. Crops can't do that effectively. And these farmers are critical to the part of the transition to net zero. How about we fund more sustainably expertise on farms? Is it all, is the onus here all on farmers, or is it us as consumers as well? Emma Germano, of course, is the president of the Victoria's Farmer Federation. And Emma, I spoke to you off air and I said, you know what, this is going to rev people up, but this is a conversation we want to have. Is there too much pressure on farmers here, or are changes already being made and we're just not aware of them?
Oh, I think that just to start with, I mean, it's great to have meaningful conversation and debate around this particular issue. So many people in Australia have indicated it's the top priority when it comes to voting in the next federal government, that climate change and climate targets are very much part of the way that they're going to make those decisions. It's so important that we have meaningful debate and we stop probably circling around ideology of climate change and actually start talking about ideas, and that's where we're actually going to start making progress. So, you know, it's great that we're having the conversation.
Technology, not taxes, is a line that's being thrown around at the moment. Is that what it's about?
I guess farmers have, you know, the last few people who have called in talking about whose responsibility is it, and farmers have, you know, so much skin in this game, and what we're actually saying, and I'm really pleased VFF has passed a climate change policy, we're saying give us the tools. It's all well and good. Like one of the callers said, you know, most farmers absolutely acknowledge climate change and, yes, the coal face, all of those things, but we really need the meaningful tools. And people have to understand that some of the science on this is still out, to build from Mildura's point. You know, the methane cycle and cattle, and is the methane that's coming out of the air that the cattle, you know, it's different from methane from gas and coal, and all of those things have to be sorted out, and we just simply have to be given the tools, acknowledged for the good work that's been happening already and has happened already, and then, you know, what are we doing to move forward to those net emission targets?
This is Texia. I'm a beef and wine producer. There is certainly a shift in consumer desire for provenance, and our buyers, which includes supermarkets, butchers and large suppliers, are also seeking finer detail and more boxes ticked so that they can show that to the consumer. If more people grew things, swapped, shared, bartered and understood the things that they consume, the world would be a simple and happy place, I reckon. Now, that's from a beef producer, and a little later in the program, Emma, we're actually going to speak to a man that's trying to make communities responsible for their own food so that we sort of almost don't need to look at huge intensive farming. Do we need to, in order to continue to feed us all though, do we need to actually localise it a little more?
Oh, I think the reality of the globalised world market means that whilst some people will have the opportunity to do that, others will not. And when I don't think it's going to be back to the future in regards to, you know, the changing of the way that our supply chains work. We're a globalised population now and we're all producing food for each other. We're eating food from around the world. Yes, some of that will help. You know, like we've been saying, that there's no silver bullet. If you've got the opportunity to buy something locally, if you've got the opportunity to buy something that's in season from where you are rather than having something from out of season from across the globe, like these are really conscious decisions that consumers have the power to make. But I don't see the unravelling of all of those supply chains. It's actually a sign of us getting wealthier as a global population.
Emma, while we have you, let's have a chat to Debbie. She's in Leongatha. Hi, Debbie. What did you want to say?
Hello. Yeah, look, I'm just a small person in the community, but as far as there was a gentleman on earlier saying how to stop eating meat and return all the animals to the wild. We're actually beef farmers, and number one, I personally have stopped eating meat and I am healthier, but not everyone can do that because some people do need to eat meat. Every individual human is an individual human with their health needs. And secondly, we can't return all the animals to the wild. I mean, that would be lovely, but unfortunately, animals would get very wormy, diseased and horribly inbred. So it really would turn to a very bad situation. And I think that it's great that the butchers are selling more meat because I think a lot of people have gone back to the older way of doing bulk cooking. I've been doing it myself, you know, because with the whole COVID situation, we don't know what's around the corner. So, yeah, you do a bit of bulk cooking, bulk up your freezer. It's really good.
So, Debbie, as a beef farmer that doesn't eat meat, I mean, I love it when stereotypes are just broken down in one small sentence. What would actually help you towards, I guess, climate-friendly farming? What are the changes that would help you in your day-to-day business and practice?
I would have to have a think about that. I can't actually answer that question. I just, look, to me, the summers, I'm 52 years old. The summers that we had when I was, say, like 6 and 8 years old were so red hot. It was just unbelievable. The summers we have now are cold compared to what I grew up with. I don't know. Look, I don't know how to change the weather. The weather is what it is. It's a massive situation to try and make changes to that. So I don't think I'm actually educated enough to be able to really comment on that. I don't know. I listen to a lot of what gets said about it and all, but I don't really have answers for
that's
it.
That's okay. Good on you, Debbie. Thanks for calling in.
Michelle, can I chime in on that?
Yeah, absolutely.
I was just going to say, I think Debbie's just absolutely highlighted the problem. So everyone's going, farmers, you've got to change. And the farmers are saying, you have to give us the tools to change. It has to be easy. It has to be tangible. It has to be something that I can very easily calculate what my net emissions are on my farm, that I can understand what soil sequestration means, because it's not as simple as just saying, oh, yeah, we've got the capacity to sequester all of this carbon. We have to have the soil technology to be able to capture that carbon back into the soil. So the fact that small producers are saying, we understand, and you know, Debbie's saying that she's given up meat for both health and climatic reasons, and that's a great thing, but we need to be giving every farmer the tool to be able to do what the community's asking us to do, and that we've all got to have that skin in the game, because at the end of the day, farmers will be doing this on behalf of the entire population, and we're simply talking about the food we eat. It's a little bit different than the widgets that we buy for fun. We're literally talking about what sustains us.
Well, I think Will and Druin would agree with that. Will, welcome. What did you want to say?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with everything just said. So let me describe my situation. I've got a small beef farm just in West Gippsland, and we'll be getting out of that in the next 10, 15 years, but we get no support from the National Party for that in terms of, you know, revegetation or lower carbon farming. I think that's a real missed opportunity.
So what sort of support would you want? What would help?
Well, I don't know. I mean, advice and policy support and subsidies, ultimately, I guess, to transition. Because we can't afford, you know, we have a mortgage for a small commercial farm, so we have to, you know, pay the bills there. But modern technology, artificial meat, something that hasn't been raised yet.
So, Will, are you a first-generation farmer?
Yeah, sort of, third generation.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm just interested because if that's something that you're going to leave quite often, you know, we are seeing a lot of first-generation farmers coming in, but on a small scale. But if it's something that you're going to leave, you know, is that potentially a family business that we will see the end of?
Yes, absolutely. But at the moment, it has to be run as a beef farm because otherwise it just would be overrun with weeds and blackberries. It can't transition at this stage. So, yeah, just wondering, worry about the future of small farms.
Will, thank you. Emma, I mean, you've been listening to Will there. I mean, he's looking at leaving in sort of 10 years or so because of just lack of support, lack of technology, lack of information, lack of education. It's a lot of things that he rattled off there.
And I think one of my favourite lines is it's hard to be green when you're in the red. So we can't put a further impost onto farming businesses where, you know, in a lot of cases you don't have a lot of control over how much money you're going to make. You don't have control over the supply chain. You don't have control over the weather. You don't know whether or not China's going to turn off its exports tomorrow. There's a lot of risk that farming businesses take on behalf of Australian consumers and the community, and we have to be able to address that. We're saying at the VFF we want to see financial support for adaptation and the mitigation efforts on farm. It has to be about, you know, assisting people to have renewable energy technology. They have to have input efficiency. They have to have stock and water feeding infrastructure. We have to have land management that, I mean, we had a insane bushfire not so long ago where that much carbon was you know, let out into the environment, and we were saying, had you managed the land differently, then we wouldn't have had that. So there's so many pieces of the little puzzle that we have to put together, but we have to start by saying, look at what farmers have done. So, you know, it's always blame the farmers and there's more livestock and you're clearing more land, but if you actually look at the gains over the last 30 years, agriculture has done this amazing stuff by itself without any prompting. You know, we were thinking about our emissions long before it was cool. So we've got to actually be thinking about what's the reality of the situation and how do we just tangibly start moving the dial in the other direction. So targets are great, but if you've got no steps moving forward, a strategy as to how you're going to reach them, then they're just really lovely things to say. So you need to have that research and development, the investment in that research and development, so that we understand what we're doing. There's no point just hurtling down a particular path. You know, there was the point that Dr. Chris made around, you know, change your meat to poultry. Well, there's other considerations with poultry. So if we go into intensive poultry farming, what do we do with all of the manure? There's environmental considerations to think about that are beyond just carbon emissions. Like, we have to take a more holistic view of how to be sustainable environmentally as we farm, because there's more to it than just that. So again, you know, we've said, yeah, we don't want to disrupt the soil because we know that we lose carbon. And then at the same time, people say, but you're not allowed to use glyphosate because we want to use less herbicides. There's trade-offs that farmers make and the industry makes every single day. And what's better than pointing an accusatory finger and biting literally the hand that feeds you is to say, well, look what they've done and how do we understand those trade-offs and how do we make conscious decisions as consumers that actually assist farmers to be able to be financially sustainable? Because once farmers are no longer financially sustainable, no one's going to be thinking about whether or not the environment is. And it's really interesting to think about it from the perspective of how we do farming in a developed country compared to undeveloped countries and the way that they do farming, where the considerations are completely different. If you've got we're looking at the Amazon and the deforestation that's occurring there, that's because those communities are starving. They have to feed their family. And we've got to make sure that we keep balance in the conversation, because otherwise, what are we going to do?
Yeah, I guess a lot of us just feel there's an urgency to that. But Emma, it's always really interesting to speak with you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much, and thanks for that conversation.
Good on you. Emma Germano, she's the president of the Victorian Farmers Federation. But Tim Kingmore is a pig farmer just near Echuca. Now, Tim, you've been working for a long time towards going pretty much completely solar.
Good morning. And exactly, we're actually building a new pig farm, intensive pig farm at the moment, and it is off the grid at the moment. It's using generators, but in the long term, once we've generated enough of our pig poo, it will self-generate, run those generators and then solar on shed. We've been doing that on shed farms for many years.
Is this something that could then, that others could follow suit? How simple and how cost-effective, how affordable? Going solar is, it's not always a cheap option at the beginnings. You do get those benefits long-term, but at the beginning it's not cheap. So how possible is it, do you think, Tim, for others to follow suit?
Our industry, the pig industry, you know, been doing this for 30-odd years. We've probably dropped our, you know, carbon emissions by, I think it's around 69-70% already. And it isn't just solar. Solar's a tool, but we have the ability to use our effluent and generate power and also use the effluent for fertiliser. So I really think pig farming has a great story. And I think too often we get scared being intensive farmers to sell our story. And we have a great story. Where as an industry on our farms will be carbon neutral by 2025 is our goal as an industry in Australia.
Does that surprise a lot of people?
I think it does. And, yeah. And that's why I say we've got to be proud, and we've actually got to get to a point where we've got to talk about our great story, because I think farming has so many of them, and it's actually doing the story rather than talking about the bad things that, you know, a lot of people like to bring up.
So why do you think in particular pig farmers are scared to tell their story and scared to, I guess, brag about what they're doing?
I don't know if it's just pig farmers. There's part of me that would say it's, you know, human nature a bit in Australia. You don't want to be the tall poppy syndrome. And then there's also, we have to deal with animal activists. And there's too many farmers that have been just so traumatised by those experiences that it is hard to want to get up and show your face and tell the great stories. But at some point, some farmers will, and you've been fortunate to talk to many, not just today, but in many of your conversations.
Yeah, and I'm still learning incredibly as we go. Tim, thanks so much for your time. And I wanted to include Josh Collings in this conversation. Now, he's a filmmaker, but it's gone on to create, I guess, micro-farming cooperatives. It's called Acres and Acres. And when we talk about our role, Josh, consumers' roles, those of us that have probably never thrown on a pair of gumboots and walked out on a rather intensive farm, that don't have farming history in our blood, we still play a role when it comes to us working towards net zero by 2050 when it comes to farming, because we're the ones eating and consuming this produce. So could we start to produce that just within our own communities?
We're taking a bit of a different approach. Like, we've still got a bunch of amazing growers, but we're using, a tool library or facilities to share between farmers in quite a, you know, about an hour and a half sort of circle is the goal. And we've got like a little tip truck that just arrived, a tractor composting machine so we can do on-farm composting. Like all the things that make big farms really effective, by having those machines and sharing them, we can kind of be in a competitive sort of field, but then also be like smaller scale farms, which means you're in more in contact with the soil, you see your problems, you're not using chemicals and so forth.
Is it something that you're seeing grow? Like, is the interest, is it spreading out and that aim towards communities being responsible and growing their own produce? You know, how much have you seen it grown in the last couple of years?
Gosh. So it's been around for a fair while, but I guess when I started, it was just like, wow, this is a new idea. And then you just keep digging and you're like, there's so many people doing this.
Yeah.
I think we're one of the first groups to really break through with this sort of scale of equipment for small scale to share. And that's because we're using it as a community facility. I think it just opens up that opportunity for lots more people to get into it, because you don't have to have that capital. And to get into farming, one of the biggest problems for younger people is having capital. Like, you can't buy farmland. Like, the deposit is humongous. You can't get a loan. So being able to lease small lots of land, having all the equipment already at your disposal, pretty much it's, if you want to do it, then the opportunity is there. So
it's something that I've certainly seen a shift in, where, you know, sort of growing up in regional Victoria, farming families were generational, you know, and for a really long time. And it was pretty unheard of to have someone say to you, well, I'm going to become a farmer, if you didn't have farming in your blood. But
yeah,
that's changed. And it's, of course, it happens on small scale, and it may grow over time for that to become a larger scale. But that's the big shift that I've seen, is in first generation farmers.
Yes, so it's very noticeable within market gardening and also animals, but I guess it's because you have opportunity to actually produce an income off an acre-sized block. So you see it happening around urban and peri-urban sort of environments, but what we know, I come from, you know, Melbourne like 5 or 6 years ago now, but what I sort of realised is they don't have local grown food in the country either. So, in fact, it's worse, because it travels from, say, Griffith all the way to Melbourne and then all the way back to us. And that's like a 15-16-hour journey, possibly a week, touched many hands, been through many processes, whereas ours is like, you know, 30 kilometres and it's in the shops by 24 hours. So your product lasts like an extra week, 2 weeks. So
I'm still always amazed, Josh, whenever I speak to you, to remember that you're a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you been making many films lately? I mean, that industry, gosh, it's really taken a beating over the last couple of years when we've been living through this pandemic. Where are you at? Where's the camera at the moment?
Look, I lost my homes and stuff in the bushfires, and I did sort of a heavy amount of filming for media during the bushfires and stuff, and I can't use it at the moment. I need a break. It was it's traumatizing. It wasn't at the time. It was a way for me to get through the grief, but I just can't even use it. So my iPhone's pretty much the only thing I do for social media. And I think I'm going to start doing some stuff around the project, but I don't want to do any crap for anyone that doesn't have meaning, really.
Yeah.
I see the market garden stuff, I guess, became viable because I just had no house to renovate. I had no business because of COVID. And I'm just like, well, might as well garden. So it's put all my time and every, you know, minute of living into that. So it's really coming to life. And we've got an amazing team. So, yeah, really skilled people. Like, I'd be the least skilled. But I'd love it. And I have gardened for like 10 years, so I'm not, I know nothing, but our team is, yeah, we've got some great people on board. So
I'm always fascinated whenever I speak to those, especially that work behind the camera. It is what gets you through, you know, but what you're seeing through the lens is so intense. It's quite literally up close, you know, that it's magnified and that it's so focused and that it does have an impact on you. So, you know, maybe it is a good chance to put the camera down for a while and just get your hands dirty.
Yeah, I do get a bit jealous when I see some amazing stuff coming out. I'm like, oh,
I could be doing that
too. But I think that's
you're doing amazing
process,
stuff
right?
Anyhow.
Yeah, yeah.
If so people want to get in touch with you, Josh, if they want some information on Acres and Acres or maybe they think it's something that they can contribute to or that they could replicate in their community, can they contact you?
Yes, so acresandacres.com.au or our Facebook page. So we're after, we've got a few spots for hiring people. We just received a very large grant from Bushfire Recovery Victoria, $550,000 to build the community to a library. So we've got some funding also for staff. So we're after a lead farmer. So if anyone out there that has everything at their fingertips, we have it. And we are also expanding throughout the northeast. So if you are in that area, we have equipment that can help get you started. So that's northeast Victoria. You know, we've got someone down in Beechworth, a member. Our membership's really growing, and we're hoping to have 20 farms involved by the end of next year, and running 5 of our own. So,
wow, oh, it's incredible. Good on you. Thanks, Josh.
Thank
I wish you all the best.
Much. Okay,
that's Josh Collings. He's created a micro farming cooperative. It's called Acres and Acres. It's in Corryong, but as we said, it's something you can jump on and you can either contribute to or you can learn from as well. Pip Grant is the senior manager at Evoke, and very early on when we started the conversation hour, my former co-host, Mr. Warwick Long, who of course our regional listeners will hear just after 12 on the Country Hour, took me along to one of the Evoke Ag conferences, Pip, and I have to say I was just so impressed and I learnt so many things, and my terminology of ag tech came from one of your huge conferences. How advanced is the world of agriculture, especially when it comes to technology?
Look, you know, it is very advanced, but it is also growing rapidly, you know, and it is really a global technology community, and it's great to see, you know, so many collaborations and, you know, information sharing and contact points by Australian technology developers with New Zealand technology developers and US and Europe as well. So we are really benefiting in Australia from the global mindset that a lot of these companies are taking, but also their closeness to, you know, Australian farmers in actually working with Australian farmers to develop, you know, solutions for the Australian market.
Do you need a lot of money, a lot of backing or funding or private enterprise to get behind you to make these changes, you know, for this technology to be trialled, to be implemented and then to be rolled out? I mean, how reliant are we on the private sector here for that as opposed to you know, to government money?
I think we have traditionally been quite reliant on the private sector, and, you know, a lot of great innovation happens in corporate settings, and of course they've got the scale to bring it to market, but we are seeing a really rapid shift in increased trials with farmers and a closing of the gap between the people who are actually developing technology and the farmers that they're, you know, developing it for. And so we're seeing more of our, you know, early stage right through to scaled up technology providers having these great relationships with farmers at all different parts of Australia, so that they can actually really understand the problem. And, you know, a better understanding the problem means that they're just developing better solutions that, you know, are being really competitive on a global market. And we're lucky. We are growing our investment in the agri-food tech space in Australia, and we shift towards, you know, sustainable focuses in people's, you know, corporate and also investment plans. We're seeing a lot more interest in our agri-tech developers, as a lot of them are developing technology for natural resource management and to help farmers be sustainable and support their already sustainable approaches to their farm management.
Well, as I said, when I went to one of your big conferences, back when we could gather en masse, I was super impressed. Pip, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Michelle.
Pip Grant, she's the Senior Manager at Evoke. We've done many programs similar and along these lines on The Conversation Hour, so don't forget, subscribe to The Conversation Hour podcast.